When the Basement Tapes appeared for the first official time in 1975, that track, Going to Acapulco, was on it, and it hadn't been on the original bootleg version. And it was the first indication that maybe there was more to be discovered. Well, as it turns out, there was an awful lot more, 130-something tracks, which are now available on 6-CD set. And somebody who knows more about the Basement Tapes than most is Sid Griffin, and he's Skyping us from his home in London. Sid, welcome to the music show.
Hi, Andrew. It's nice to be on the music show. Thank you.
Let's talk, first of all, because there'll be plenty of people listening to this who've never heard of the Basement Tapes before, so we better just do the history and talk about what happened exactly in that period in 1967-68.
Well, Dylan had the motorcycle accident. There's debate how much the July 1966 motorcycle accident hurt him, Andrew, but he certainly used it as a fulcrum or a jumping off point, a starting off point to change his life. And by the time you get to from late July 66 to February 67, you've got an income stream that's slowly drying up. I mean, he's not touring. He's supposed to go back on the road in August, I believe it was. And he's not touring. He's not finishing the world tour. He's not doing much of anything. And for whatever reason, we don't exactly know. I'm sure Albert Grossman, his manager, was thinking, hang on, the revenue stream is going to dry up or drying up. And he called in February and got two of the guys from the band, I think it was Danko and Manuel, to leave the Gramercy Hotel in Manhattan where they were on retainer living and not doing all that much, to come up to Woodstock in February 67, originally to help him shoot some scenes, sort of like an MTV video, shoot some scenes for his Something Is Happening documentary from his world tour, the footage that he shot, not the footage D.A. Pennebaker shot. Anyway, so they were going to finish this film that Pennebaker, you know, had helped him with, but it was Bob's film. It's not a Don't Look Back film that's Pennebaker's. So he called these musicians up there to finish this, get this movie going and flesh it out in February 67. And I think, you know, we don't know, but I talked to Robbie Robertson about it several times for my book, Million Dollar Bash. And Robbie said, yeah, you know, after a while, when you're just up musicians doing something, if sooner or later somebody says, well, let's play. So here they are doing this film stuff. And sooner or later, somebody said, let's play. And they started this 5-day-a-week meeting of the Basement Tapes, and which is what they did. They met for 5 days a week, every day around noon.
The word reinvent is overused, but Bob Dylan has been a great reinventor of himself, hasn't he? And he was very, very famous at this point in his life. I mean, he'd gone electric. He was not just famous, he was notorious in a lot of circles. And then, as you say, there was the motorbike accident. And one of the things that people noticed when he reappeared was that he had a different voice, which was put down at the time to the bike accident. But maybe it goes hand in glove with the kind of material he suddenly found himself recording with the band, because there's a lot of original songs, of course, and we've just heard one of them, but they were also recording country songs, Johnny Cash, Hank Williams, old blues, lots of old folk songs, a lot of them filtered through the singing of those Appalachian singers, people like Clarence Ashley and Doc Boggs and those sorts of guys. They were in a way exploring, weren't they?
Yeah, I agree. I think Dylan wanted a new. Well, I don't think. I mean, I can't speak for Bob Dylan, Andrew. You and your listeners know that. I can't speak for Bob Dylan, but it's pretty apparent that he wanted to do something different with his life and his career. Now, just because that is in a dozens, and I mean literally dozens of Bob Dylan books, doesn't make it true, but it is something I believe, that he looked around and thought, this kind of wild music I'm making that's really out there with the Hawks and just burning down the house every night on this world tour, something's got to give. I want to change my life. I want to come back to being a human being. I don't want to be up 3 days in a row like they were. I want to change everything. And context is everything. Any kind of dramaticist or writer or theater person or a film person will tell you context is everything. If I say to somebody, I could kill you, and it's just horsing around, no one cares. And if I say to somebody in a threatening way, I could kill you, that context has a totally different meaning. So when you take a bunch of musicians, give them electric guitars, it's one thing to have them pound on them with a drummer in a rehearsal hall or in a concert situation. But as you say, they were in a different situation. They were in a guy's house. Initially, they were recording in Bob Dylan's house or rehearsing in Bob Dylan's house before they turned on the tape machine. There is no drummer because Levon Helm was not with them. He was working on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. So context being what it is in that situation, they turned their amps down. They did have mics and things, but they turned their amps down, played at a more reasonable level. And when you do that, I mean, you can ask anybody down under. You know, you can ask the Easy Beats. You don't pound out songs when you don't have a drummer and you're just in some guy's house. You have a tendency to play more calm, relaxed, reflective, inward-looking material than you do pounding on your guitar and yelling out G-L-O-R-I-A, that kind of thing. And I think that's what happened. And through this quieter approach, because again, they're in someone's house and they have no permanent drummer, I think they thought, well, what can we play? And somebody comes out with an old folk song, or the band came up with some slight bluesy kind of feel, but nothing loud and obnoxious. It was not N-O-T, Spinal Tap, with the amps turned up to 10. It was just the kind of comfortable loudness where you can hear everybody in the room.
And indeed, there are children sleeping in this house, aren't there? Is that significant, do you think?
The other way around. I know what you mean, but it's the other way around. They started at – Dylan arrived at noon, if they could get Richard Manuel out of bed, and they probably started at noon or 1, depending on what was happening. They knocked it off around 3 or 3:30. It's the other way around because Bob had a daughter by then, and he went to the bus stop, being the dutiful father that he was. He went to the bus stop towards the end of the driveway and down the road a little bit to get his daughter. So when your daughter comes back and it's now like 3:35 in the afternoon with her dad, I mean, you don't want 4 or 5 guys smoking cigarettes and drinking beer and leads all over the floor, you know, cables all over the floor and guitars on the ground and amps turned on. I'm sure Mrs. Dylan, Sarah, you know, wanted that stuff knocked off. So it's exactly what you're saying. But yeah, they knocked it off because the kids were coming home from school.
So let's talk about this new edition, all of these new songs. I mean, is this something that is essentially for the Dylan connoisseur, do you think?
Yes, I think that, yes, it's for the Dylan connoisseur, that's for sure. I couldn't, with a straight face, tell every single person on the streets of Melbourne or Sydney or Brisbane, yes, you have to own a copy of this, because it is 6 CDs, and it's pretty much for the Dylan fan on your block. But let me stress this then, Andrew, it's for every Dylan fan on your block. No Dylan fan wants to be without it. It's pretty fascinating. Does the casual pop music fan need a copy of this? Well, Jeff, Dylan's manager may kill me for saying that, but possibly not. However, riding to the rescue in my right hand, making this noise here, is the 2 CD set of Basement Tapes that the average punter on the street could get, and you'd have just the highlights of the Basement Tapes without all the flim flam. You may not have everybody in your life needing this 6 CD set, but to devotees like Sid Griffin, yeah, they need it. This is really something. I've been part of this project since May, and I wrote a book that came out in 2007. And today, Andrew, I got both my finished copies of the Basement Tapes box set and my new copies of the Million Dollar Bash book. I wrote the updated version of it. So it's been a red letter day in the Griffin house. So someone like yourself or me, yeah, dang right, you need this 6 CD set. And I think some of it's just, I really believe with a straight face, and this is not someone, I'm not one of these guys that cares what color Bob Dylan's socks are, and I don't care what he had for breakfast. Don't give a damn. But I must say that I think in 200 years, people will still write and care about Bob Dylan. I think he is the archetypal, quintessential, important American artist, and I think his music will last long after, sad to say, you and I and this wonderful show you've got are gone.
Yes, I think we can probably bank on that. What about the sheer quantity of material that's produced in this period? Because it's not just the recordings, and it's not just all of the new songs, which are really in a state of flux. I mean, some of them. I mean, something like Quinn the Eskimo, for instance, and barely has a tune, and yet in short order is turned into a big hit by Manfred Mann. But it's not. It's also the stuff that didn't get past the lyric writing stage. I mean, we now know that there are screeds of typewritten sheets that of lyrics that didn't even get to the tune point.
Yes, I think a lot of these lyrics that some of the Dylanologists have pored over with a fine tooth comb are nonsense lyrics. Or to be more specific, if you listen, there's three versions of You Ain't Going Nowhere. If you listen to the early takes, I think he's doing what the late Gene Clark of the Byrds did. In fact, I'm told Keith Richards of the Stones does this. Now, I want to stress, I don't know Bob Dylan or Keith Richards. I did know Gene Clark of the Byrds. And I think all three were famous or known for in the industry. They get a chord progression or a melody going, and they just sing any old thing that pops in their head. Many songwriters would just go la-da-da-da-da or dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, but a lot of guys, as I said, Dylan and Gene Clark and Keith Richards, they do the first thing that pops, Michael Stipe, the first thing that pops in their head, they sing. And on some of these early versions of things like, as I said, You Ain't Going Nowhere, he's singing nonsensical rubbish. He's just trying to get the song formed and going and hasn't really developed a theme yet other than the melody and a concrete chorus. And so I'm very, very, very much amused when I have these guys and gals go over to the nth degree some of these Basement Tapes lyrics, because some of Bob's original lyrics, they're just silly. They're not finished. They weren't meant to, as Robbie Robertson said, they weren't meant to be heard. A lot of this 6-CD set, which I think is just brilliant, has classic tracks that like Wild Wolf, which has just been rumored, which I've heard for the first time in the Dylan offices in June. They're just incredible. But some of the tracks are the guys playing well, but Bob Dylan just making up a nonsense song. Simple as that.
Yes. Well, I think we should listen to Wild Wolf. Since you've mentioned it and since we have it standing by and since it's now not just a rumour, tell us just in a couple of words something about Wild Wolf, because we have to wind it up after this.
Oh, okay. Well, Wild Wolf is considered such a groovy, important song by the few guys that did hear it, the few Dylanologists that did hear it, Andrew. One guy named his bootleg record label Wild Wolf, and of course they put out Bob Dylan bootlegs, funny enough. I mean, it's Dylan on vocal and acoustic guitar, it's Danko on bass, Garth Hudson on organ, Richard Manuel, the piano player, has been shunted over to the drums, and he became a fine drummer by the end of the Basement Tapes. At the beginning of the Basement Tapes, there's either no drums or Robbie Robertson or Richard Manuel stumbling around. But by the end of the Basement Tapes, Richard Manuel's a fairly good drummer and, in fact, drummed in the band's live concerts. Mm. Later on, I saw the band play twice in their original incarnation. He was a fine drummer. And Wild Wolf is the kind of thing that, you know, nobody but Bob Dylan would let it go. It's a minor chord, biblical imagery, dark, apocalyptic, the storm is coming tune. It's the kind of thing he just eats up with a knife and fork. He could just do it. And yet, like so many of these songs, like You Ain't Going Nowhere and This Wheel's on Fire and Too Much of Nothing and you know, Wild Wolf, and he just lets them go. I mean, these are songs you or I could form a band, Andrew, and base a career on. And Bob Dylan records them with these fantastic guys and lets them go, which is a weird thing because 1967, as many of your listeners will know, the only thing Bob put out was a greatest hits package, which did very well. Yet in 1967, I've done the math, he recorded more songs and wrote more original songs, and in my opinion, wrote more good original songs than in any other year of his career. But being Bob Dylan, he doesn't put any of this grade A stuff out. If you or I had written Wild Wolf or This Wheel's on Fire, I promise you our band that we had would have recorded it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, at least we can hear them now, and we will now hear Wild Wolf. And me, I just say, Sid, thank you very much indeed for staying up late and talking to us from London. Thanks for your generosity. Enjoy flicking through the new edition of your book, and enjoy the complete Basement Tapes. That'll certainly keep you off the streets for a few days, I'm sure. Sid Griffin on today's music show.
Steadily rolling and lovely.